Hi, this is Paul Gordon of the soon-to-be-released film, The Happy Poet, a film in which I sell healthy, organic sandwiches at a reasonable price. If you're looking for healthy, organic conversation at a reasonable price, you can't do much better than this week's Tribcast. I don't know if you noticed, but it's free. And now, here's your host.
Thank you. This is reporter Reeve Hamilton here with the Tribcast for the last week of September. Joining me is executive editor Ross Ramsey.
That was a high-energy fellow, wasn't it?
Have you seen The Happy Poet yet?
I haven't seen the movie. I've seen the Evan Smith promo, which is pretty fantastic.
Yeah. I think we're going to put a clip up of that at the end of this.
All right.
I like the one with the girl who thinks she's having a love poem read to her.
Ben Philpott of KUT in the Texas
Tribune. Sorry, I stepped out of line. I'm usually the last person introduced.
Reporter Jay Root is also here.
Hello.
Famous Arthur Jay Root.
Author Jay Root.
Famous Arthur.
Arthur.
His first name is Arthur. Arthur Joseph Root. Goes by Jay.
Actually, you pretty much said my son's name, which is Benjamin Arthur Joseph Root.
Really?
Wow. Yeah.
Whoa.
Well, can we get him in here?
You just kind of channeled it, didn't you? You channeled it.
I didn't even know that. The Happy Poet, we should say, in full disclosure, was produced by David Hartstein, who is the husband of one of the staff members of the Tribune, but that's still a mystery, lingering from the previous podcast as to whose it is exactly.
Okay.
Who knew that Evan, could act that way? I mean, he's a pretty darn good actor.
I don't think people know what we're talking about right now.
Okay. The Happy Poet is a movie that's
Evan
coming out.
Evan did a promo for it. We'll put a clip at the end
but
of
But Evan's
this.
In it, right?
No, he's not in the movie.
Oh, I thought he was
just
in it.
The promo.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, just in the promo clip.
Yeah. Let's talk about what we're going to talk about instead of that. We're going to do a bit of navel
gazing. Let's sell some books.
Yeah, we're going to do a bit of navel gazing today. We're going to talk about the Texas Tribune Festival and the Texas Tribune's own Jay Root's book. And I think that's about it. Maybe we'll talk about the new Mumford & Sons album. Have you guys read?
Did you watch their free concert on iTunes
Movies,
yesterday?
Music, politics.
Reeve is dying to direct the Tribcast toward culture and music, right?
Well, I don't know about dying.
He you could like see to. A place
Living
for it.
We could start by maybe getting Ted Nugent on.
Let's talk about the Texas Tribune Festival, which was a big cultural event. What was the big takeaway for you, Ben?
I think that about 75 to 80% of the people that hosted panels at the Tribune Fest were very disappointed that the more interesting panel was happening across the hallway. My panel happened at the exact same time that name calling was going on between lawmakers and Perry staffers next door. That was Dear DeLisi and Senator Corona.
This is always the problem. It's like ACL. You know, the band you
right,
want to listen to
it.
Is up against the band you want to listen to. You know, there were, no matter whether you were moderating or you were just going to this thing, there was always something else going on in addition to what you were listening to.
Yes, my panel was on light rail and its use in transportation systems in the urban cities here in Texas. And I think it was quite informative and a fine panel, but, you know, all the tweets were about the name calling across the hallway.
We should be clear that Senator John Corona was calling Deirdre DeLisi names, not vice versa.
Yes, he called her a Perry crony,
and she didn't take to that well.
And she didn't like that.
I didn't know that when I asked.
It was
you
that, kind of a drive by. It was like a nice 55-minute session, and in the last 5 minutes, it kind of took that veer. It was sort of unexpected.
I sort of didn't expect Ben to just start by complaining about the placement of his own panel.
No. I said 80%. I think that there was all... Ross said it better than I did. It was like being at ACL or South by Southwest. There were so many really good things going on that you were bound to miss something, and that's just the way it is.
Sticking with the music theme, I think it was Aaron Pena who said, and maybe other people have said this, that it's like a concert for nerds. And I thought what was really... This was my first Trib Fest because I did not do the one last year.
Second overall, first for Jay.
Yeah, second one overall, first for me. And I was struck by how much hunger there is out there. And maybe it's a niche, but there's a lot of hunger out there for public discussion. I think we've seen sort of, an atrophy in that over the years. And there's just, I mean, I remember at the panel on the presidential election that Julie Mason and Gwen Ifill and Rick Hertzberg did. There were people in line to ask questions like 5 or 6 people deep at each mic when it was time, when, you know, the time finally ran out. I mean, I think that thing could have gone on for 3 hours.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, we're going to, I should say, we're going to put up audio of all of the sessions. We're going to put up video of some of the sessions. We didn't have video on everything, but, you know, there will be audio. So if you missed something or if you didn't go to the festival, you can catch up on this stuff. I think you're right. I think a lot of people want to talk about these issues. You sort of get out of a non-legislative hearing environment. So it's not just, you know, somebody presenting and then getting a couple of legislator questions. They're actually arguing with other smart people. And they get this, you know, there's this sort of, when you get political people up there, there's this sort of phenomena that you kind of go through the first 20 minutes and everybody is sort of playing their greatest hits. And then you get into the second 20 minutes and the third 20 minutes and they really having to think and dig deep. And it actually gets sort of interesting in a lot of these panels.
I was really struck by the Joe Strauss panel that I live blog. I feel in a way like I didn't do it justice because, you know, when you're live blogging, you just sort of blurt and you don't necessarily have time to get some of the full quotes. But I was struck with how he is not afraid to sound reasonable. We've sort of gotten into a political environment where we expect the partisans or the people to represent kind of what you would expect from a statewide political candidate. And when you and Joe Strauss is a statewide figure, but not a state, doesn't run statewide, so right. He obviously knows how to get reelected to his own district. But he just sounded so reasonable and that he wasn't afraid to sound reasonable. I just thought that was very interesting.
Well, didn't he field a Satan question like so many other people?
Yeah, and that was another one that was hilarious. He said, well, I can tell you one thing. Satan's not going to be a committee chairman in the House or whatever. And that everybody laughed. That was really funny.
So
well,
Satan opened the events on Friday night with the Rick Perry, Evan Smith conversation.
The very first line.
Right.
Rick Perry said, Evan asked him about his comments where he said that
Satan was the reason.
Efforts to separate church and state around the country was the work of Satan. And Evan asked about that. And his first sentence was, I just want to go on the record saying, I believe in Satan.
Which became a running theme throughout the rest of the festival. Which is a weird way to say it in a way, you know, that. Because, you know, you'd think people say, I believe in Christ or I believe whatever, I believe in some deity. It just was weird. And, of course, what he meant was, I believe that Satan exists and all of that. But it was just kind of jarring to write that quote down.
Is that what he meant? It wasn't clear.
Yeah. Well, it was actually sort of interesting. And you know, it was in some ways. I wasn't at the Strauss thing. I was at Steve Murdoch's deal at the same time. But, you know, it's kind of an anti-soundbite culture, you know, when you do a festival like this. They've got to talk in whole sentences and paragraphs. And, you know, the takeaway soundbite from Perry was the I believe in Satan. But it was actually sort of a weird but interesting 5 minutes for the beginning of that conversation.
Does it matter if he believes in Satan? Like, that got a lot of play and a lot of news.
So it's not – it's completely within his previously stated belief structure. I mean, he is an evangelical Christian who, you know, evangelical Christians and Christians in general have a belief in heaven and hell and Satan. And it's like he never – you know, you spend a lot of time publicly stating your belief in Jesus and God, and you don't tend to focus on the other end quite so much. But he finally did this time. But it's not like it wasn't already there in his belief structure. He just voiced it this time.
Well, I think that, you know, if you look at the reaction sort of in the Twitter sphere, it was sort of like you just don't hear Satan that often. The word Satan, I mean, it's kind of church lady-ish, isn't it? I mean,
I was thinking of the, it would have been great if
Evan
had suddenly
special?
Morphed into Dana Carvey up there.
Yeah. Satan?
But there is something about talking about it in this. This is very much like a politics and policy festival,
right.
And to bring the notion and sort of this,
the
you know,
dark prince.
A notion of Satan in a very sort of anthropomorphized sort of being with agency sort of way, and the political context is a bit off-putting, perhaps, to many.
It wasn't anthro what?
What did he say?
Can I get some of that kill them fire ants in my yard?
You know, if you've been around Perry a lot, you know, it probably leads into the book for Jay. But, you know, if you've been around Perry a lot, it wasn't really that surprising. And it wasn't really we weren't outside of his zip code at all.
I don't think anybody at the Trib Fest either was surprised by that. But I do think, though, that it got national attention. I mean, it's national publications have picked it up and, you know, it sort of just becomes like something bizarre, you know. bizarre political development.
I thought the, I don't know if shocking is the right word, but I thought the most interesting part of that Perry sit down with Evan was him doubling down on the idea of tuition for undocumented children.
Actually, I did too. And he,
I mean, he as he was saying his answer, you know, I was waiting for it. You know, he got a massive bloody nose from this on the campaign trail. It was one of the first missteps.
Yeah, he got a bad back.
Well,
I'm trying to carry it.
That's true. Actually, in Jay's book, there's no mention of a bloody nose, but
he couldn't sleep at all after that.
But you know, that was kind of one of the first missteps, or you know, if you consider a misstep, that led to his downfall. And I was, when that question was asked, I kind of expected him to back away from it, and instead he used almost the exact same language that he used in that debate on the campaign trail. Children, through no fault of their own, coming to America, we made an economic decision.
He didn't say you don't have a heart.
He didn't say that. But he essentially said, well, he didn't say he wouldn't veto it, or he would veto it, but he said, I don't think it'll show up on my desk. I don't think there's
Yeah, but what he also said was, I'm ready to have that conversation. I don't expect
it
to show up to my...
An open and vigorous debate seemed to be the key phrase that he used.
And if you have an open and vigorous debate, he didn't say he wouldn't veto it if it does happen to come to his desk. He just said he doesn't expect it to
come to his desk. He did say that the legislature made the correct choice then, and he still thinks it's a correct choice.
I took the talk about that it probably wouldn't come to his desk. The way I interpreted that was, you know, that he's sending the signal out, you know, this is veto bait,
basically. It's a pre-veto. It's
right.
Right.
Well, you don't say I'm going to veto it. You just say, well, you know, they can have that discussion all they want, but it's probably not going to get to my desk. Like, message, don't try it.
You say that, and then the lieutenant governor and the speaker of the House have a lot to do with whether or not something then gets to his desk.
Right. I wonder about his read. You know, I mean, he's been great at this, so I'm not criticizing it. I'm just curious about it. I'm wondering about his read of the new legislature. One of the things he said in this conversation was, you know, only four people voted against this last time. And Evan followed by saying, you got four people in the new Senate who are going to vote against it. He said, well, there's your four.
That was a really good line.
I think the number that is...
Except that there's a lot more than four.
On your feet.
I think the number of people that are coming into the Texas legislature who would like to reverse that policy is a lot bigger than four. And I think this could be a really interesting issue in the session.
Absolutely. And the Tea Party activists, this is a very, very high priority. Immigration reform, or, you know, state curbs, e-verify. There are a whole lot of things like that that the Tea Party people who got a lot of these people elected. I mean, the Tea Party was all the rage in 2010, sort of statewide.
Is it still Tea Party anymore?
It sort of died down. Down as a, you know, general election phenomenon, in the sense of, you know, maybe there was less talk about it, but within the Republican primary, it just was just as strong, I believe, in 2012, if not stronger than it was in 10. And you're right, Ross, there are going to be a lot of these conservative Tea Party backed members of the legislature, and you know, this is way different from 2001.
Right.
It's post 9/11. You know, Texas used to be one of those places where, you know, immigration reform was a non-starter. It's not that way anymore. We're very much like other states now on that issue.
Right. Yeah. And to your question, Reeve, I mean, a lot of candidates, particularly in the Republican primary, had this sort of good housekeeping looking stamp on their homepages that said Tea Party approved, Tea Party certified. It was a big deal.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, and you know, it will be interesting because last session, when, you know, there was a bill to try to get rid of the in-state tuition stuff, and the reason it couldn't get through is because it didn't have enough Republican support. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not. But this time around, you know, I talked to Donna Campbell, who may very well be, probably will be the senator from District 25, replacing Jeff Wentworth, and she presented herself as, you know, coming in to sort of give backup. It was sort of like the cavalry coming in to help the Republican senators that are already in there. And this could be an issue where they really have an effect.
Yeah, I think we may get a showdown. They may send it to his desk and see what happens.
Yeah.
Could be interesting.
Any other news coming out of the either the Perry interview or any other panels you guys went on? I learned that Angelo State University is going to roll out its version of a $10,000 degree in the next 2 weeks. So if you...
That was another piece of news from the Perry thing.
Oh, the four-year freeze.
Right.
Sort of news.
Well, it's been talked about before, and, you know...
Yeah, he said it in his State of the State address last year.
Right, and this is the idea that you start at a price when you enter school, and you hold that price for 4 years. Have any of the colleges actually adopted that? I know it was in the State of the State.
Yeah, look for my story on it.
Spoiler alert.
Coming up this week. Yeah, so UT Dallas does this.
Uh-huh.
UT El Paso has it as an option. And it's one of those things, one of these things you see it a lot also with the $10,000 degree is a good example. Sort of, it's really hard to come up with a price lowering strategy that is going to work at every university. UT Dallas, it works really well. They also have a student population that is more money and is more likely to graduate in 4 years.
Yeah, what's the per year cost at UT Dallas?
At UT Dallas, it's the most expensive
university
in the state. And that's because if you're going to do this strategy, you have to like look ahead and sort of balance out.
Right.
So you're paying a little more in your first year and a little less in your fourth year than you would otherwise, but it all sort of evens out. So their price is a little higher. Their price at UT Dallas is also higher because they're largely a science and engineering school, and those are more expensive majors. But so at UT El Paso, they offered it as an option, and it was very unpopular, basically because students there are – the majority of students don't graduate in 4 years. They sort of know that they're not. They're trying to work as well. They were trying to work their way through college, which slows them down.
And so they
would rather just sort of like risk that the tuition isn't going to jump up hugely each year than sort of lock themselves into this price and then get screwed on the fifth or sixth year.
So they could like at the fifth year, like, oh, you're priced out. You can't even continue.
So, you know, it works at UT Dallas. It hasn't really worked at UT El Paso.
I mean, but the way you were describing the way they're doing it at UT Dallas, doesn't that kind of
show that it's not really a cost saving?
I mean, they're averaging the 4 years.
Well, but you know, on the other hand, it introduces certainty into something that's completely uncertain. Okay.
What it is predictability for financial planning for families, it is also an incentive to get out in 4 years. Really, the best way to save money if you're going through school is to get out as fast as possible. Right? Really, there's no other strategy that really
drives
works,
down the cost.
Know? Like,
spend
the thing
less
is, the
time
thing is,
there.
The schools can bring down the price of college, but the cost of educating a student hasn't really changed over the years. You know, so someone's going to be bearing that cost, and just is it going to be mostly on the student, mostly on the state? Is it going to be mostly on the federal government through grants and stuff? It's really just sort of finding the acceptable balance in there. Now, some of this stuff is changing. You know, we're seeing more and more moves to competency-based advancement and stuff.
Is it sort of a gimmick, though, in a way? Because there's no more money going into education. I mean, you know, if you artificially hold the price low, then the money's got to be made up somewhere. So, I mean, I don't understand. You know, it's like if we just say we're going to freeze something, is that really a policy initiative that has any real meat on it that, you know, there's no more money going into higher ed?
Well, also, what he's calling for, the terminology has sort of been confused. He's not calling for a tuition freeze. He's calling for locking in students' tuition.
Right.
Right? So he's not saying that schools can't increase their tuition.
Unless it's UT Austin and A&M.
Right. But that's not what he said at the speech.
That's not what he said.
But what he called for in his speech is, you know, freshmen have to pay. He wants schools to make it so that freshmen pay the same amount for 4 years. Whatever they pay as freshmen, they'll pay as juniors and seniors. A tuition freeze would really be the school can't increase tuition. But I could increase tuition higher for the next incoming class, and they will pay that for 4 years than the previous incoming class.
He wants to create – it's very similar, I guess, to the $10,000 degree. And he wants to create a predictable little package deal that you purchase.
Well, the $10,000 degree, that's another thing that every school – There are now $10,000 degrees all around the state, which people didn't expect even a year ago, but they're all set up differently. Some of them are more smoke and mirrors than they are a sort of a real option for students, but some of them are really innovative and interesting. And so, you know, it's sort of schools have to take these ideas and try to work them, and if they can get a workable model, you know, see which one of those can scale. I mean, it's sort of to be determined, but it's not like he can just say that and realistically expect it to work at every university.
Right. And, one of the arguments that the Perry people made early in this thing, I think you reported, was that, you know, even if you don't get a $10,000 degree out of it, you start the conversation, you start people trying for it, and you can maybe lower the price of college or put college within reach of some people who can't reach it now.
Yeah.
That was the argument.
Yeah. That was a bit of a tangent. That wasn't planned.
So there's a book here out?
Oops, A Diary from the 2012 Campaign Trail. That's what it's called.
And who wrote it?
I did. It's at Amazon.com. Type my name in.
Is it also not on Apple?
Yeah, it's on Apple. Yes. And is that how you got it, on Apple?
No, I got it through your publicist.
Oh. Okay, sorry. Are you getting a report? We don't pay for anything.
If you contact Jay's publicist.
It's on Barnes & Noble Nook. It's on Kindles from Amazon. And
I do plan on purchasing a copy as well.
Thank you. Funny how different it is when you're on the other side. It's kind of like, you know, when and now I'm like, give me your free book. And now I'm like, hey, will you go ahead and buy it?
So if I am a person, you know, let's pretend I'm a normal
person. That's a big if, but go ahead.
Why do I care about the Perry campaign today, a year after he ran and failed to succeed in that run, you could argue.
This is this sounds like Reeves pitching for a free book.
Oh, I've read it. Believe me.
Let's give you a little pub too. I have a chapter in there called The Guest Diaries.
And I'm the guest.
Right. So for one reason, reason to look at it is see Morgan Smith's take and Reeve Hamilton's take. I would say that there's something that, you know, obviously this is charitable to me, but I think it's somewhat timeless. There's something timeless about it where it's sort of anatomy. A friend of mine who Gary Rasp, who read it for me in advance because he's a good writer, and I said, hey, you know, give me some – what do you think? And he wanted to call it an anatomy of a campaign meltdown. So it's very much like you are there as a campaign starts to come apart. I would also say that, gaffes are kind of all the rage now, and I think that it's partially because there have been some interesting gaffes in this campaign cycle. I mean, the latest one that everybody's talked about is this 47% thing with it Romney did. But I think that it speaks to the new way campaigns are sort of unfold in today in America with YouTube and Twitter and gaffes are sort of blown up more than they ever have been, and the ubiquitous nature of video is such that Tip O'Neill said that all politics is local, and I make the point in the book that all politics is national now. I mean, you say something in Des Moines, and it's immediately everywhere on YouTube, and if it's hot, man, it just goes viral. And so that's something that didn't happen before.
It's almost like schoolyard politics. It's almost like you can hear the Simpson kid, you know, the Nelson kid in the background going, ha-ha. That's kind of how politics works now. It's like, you know, so-and-so fell off the slide, and so-and-so ran into somebody on the swing, and it's kind of got that, and everything goes through the schoolhouse. It's the nation goes through the schoolhouse really quickly, and everybody knows everything about everybody. All the embarrassing stuff comes out. It's an interesting way to run,
which has led to this wonderful, this wonderful new way of running campaigns where you don't actually have a debate over ideas or policy. It's great, right? Yeah.
I thought it was interesting. Okay. You know, one of the things that Julie Mason said during the TribFest was people are probably hungering more for issues. And honestly, there aren't a whole lot of issues in my book. I mean, this is more, you know, what it's like to watch a campaign just explode in a spectacular fashion.
There's more drinking than issues.
Yeah, there probably is. But I do think that there is kind of a lack of that. I mean, if it can't be digested in 140 characters or if it's not very quickly understandable, then I do think that there's sort of a very low attention span.
You make a point of this in one of the scenes in the book when we're at Wofford. Governor Perry, was this the first? No, it wasn't the first debate after the oops, was it?
Wofford, that was in Spartanburg, right? That was after
it was
oops.
Like 2 weeks after or something.
Right.
So he had, you know, he was... The downward trajectory had sped up, but he had a good debate. It was a foreign policy debate, and he laid out this zero budgeting idea that he always pushes in Texas as a way to talk about what kind of foreign aid we give. And you know, you and I had the conversation at the debate. You know, that's actually a conversation starter. It's an interesting idea. It's something that, you know, people might be talking about in the next news cycle because it was a specific policy idea on how to deal with foreign aid. It didn't matter at that point for Governor Perry because no one was ready to jump back on that ship.
He no longer had the pulpit.
Right.
Right.
But it was like, you know, it took, I mean, it was one of these moments where essentially the campaign was throwing everything at the wall to see what would stick, and he threw a policy idea, but he was...
Well, I would argue they've had plenty of policy argument in this presidential campaign. I mean, you know, you're talking about...
And state tuition is a policy.
Right. State tuition, the whole argument over 47%, the whole argument over Medicare, the whole argument over Paul Ryan stuff. Everybody's talking about $716 billion from Medicaid. I mean, there's a bunch of policy in this thing. The thing that happened to Perry really was that, you know, he kind of came apart on policy issues, on the Bernanke thing, on the Dream Act, and on a couple of other things. By the time he got to Oops, he was already dead in the polls.
Yeah, that's a very good point. You know, but there were also there were really two. I mean, the Orlando debate, which was in late September, almost exactly a year ago, and he had that in-state tuition thing. He said people were heartless, but it was like a double punch because there was a policy thing that people were just insulted by. I mean, I talk about in the book how, like, and this really happened. Like, you go into elevator and can you believe that Rick Perry? It was, you know, they were insulted by this in-state tuition thing. But then he also had that spell, as I call it. I mean, it was like he basically. There was this gibberish. I mean, that's what some people called it, gibberish, when he said, is it was before.
Was he was before he was before.
Right. And I mean, this was like self-immolation. I mean, it was just.
Is it people that don't have the attention span for policy discussions, or is it the press? Because, you know, when I was on the bus with Perry in Iowa, at that point he was so far down the polls, but he still had a lot of embedded reporters, and really because they were just on. You know, gaffe patrol, because that stuff gets page views and clicks and
Look at the regular viewership of the cable news channels and of C-SPAN. I mean, that answers that question. I mean, when you go to something, when you go to something like TripFest, you get a bunch of people who are interested in policy and politics. And actually, we had a couple of sort of verbal knife fights at that thing, but for the most part, they were on content and they were on substance. And, you know, when you're talking in a political environment, you know, people are looking for differences on policy that affect them, but they're also looking for the other guy to make a mistake or be a doofus or, you know, step on his shoelaces or whatever. And, you know, that does tend to dominate.
Another thing that, you know, why would you read this? That was like the Romney campaign. And again, this is all seen through my eyes and seen through my experience covering Rick Perry. But if you look at the way the Romney campaign operated during the primary, it was fascinating because, like, they reached out to people in advance and knew how it was. You know, there was sort of this game of whack-a-mole where, you know, every time and Rick Perry was sort of the test case because he was the first one that, you know, before that, Politico had said that Romney was in the Mitness Protection Program, you know, basically saying that it was a great little term that they came up with, but that he was, he just was at this 30,000 foot type of campaign where he didn't even acknowledge that anybody else was in the campaign. Well, when Rick Perry sort of grabbed the front runner mantle, he had to get his hands dirty, and they were so ready for that. Yep. I mean, they were like, Romney campaign was. They had. The opposition research that they had gathered on the campaigns was so well put together, so deep, and so easily accessible and easily provided to reporters. I think they set a new standard.
Yeah, I mean, one of the Romney operatives, I mean, he was on first-name basis with all the Rick Perry reporters for, you know, the 3 weeks that they felt Rick Perry was a threat. And,
exactly.
And I haven't received any emails from Ryan.
Right, exactly. But you know, I mean, you know they were doing that with the report, the Gingrich embeds.
Next time, that's right.
I mean, like, the Romney campaign, like you said, was on a first-name basis with all of the embeds, the embedded reporters in all of the other campaigns.
So,
I mean, it's brilliant.
Let me put you guys on the spot a little bit. Can you think of an example where they just sort of, you know, laid something out when they kind of came down from their 30,000 feet and said, you know, okay, let's start talking about Rick Perry. Here's, you know, item.
Well, I think that I think I can say this, and we'll cut it out if not. We were talking with one of the Romney operatives one time about the big story at that moment was the way Governor Perry was funding plane rides. Was he using campaign money correctly in purchasing planes to fly around to campaign stops? And the Romney operative said, this was a story that was written by a New York Times reporter, and the Romney operative said, well, you know, we gave him more than that. I mean, I believe he dug up more than that. Completely doing it sarcastically. I mean, you know, it wasn't a gaffe, mm-hmm. but...
Wink, wink.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it was simply, you know, when something happened and became newsworthy, you know, they had, like, the files. I mean, I can think of some examples, you know, on in-state tuition. I mean, they had really studied that. They studied the record.
Mm-hmm.
And I just didn't see that. I mean, there may have been other campaigns, and maybe I'm sure that, I mean, why would they necessarily come? Why would, you know, Newt Gingrich is not necessarily going to come to me? I don't know. I mean, that it wasn't that kind of, I didn't get that from any other campaign, number one. And number two, I'm not sure what was going on. You know, maybe the Rick Perry people were giving opposition research on other people to reporters from out of
to the
state.
Romney embeds or
I'm
whatever,
not sure, right. But I mean, the thing is that I you know, in this age, even though we're a Texas publication, anything you put up on the internet is if it's a good story, can potentially go anywhere. So I'm not sure why we weren't getting at least some of that.
So did Romney sink Perry, or did Perry sink Perry?
I think
answer quickly. We're running out of time.
Perry sunk Perry.
Yeah.
And what does this mean for if he has any 2016 ambitions?
What, the book, you mean?
Yeah.
I mean, I think it would be an opportunity to sell it again in 2016.
Well, I mean, do you think this was fatal? I mean, does he have resurrection opportunities here?
Since
we started with Satan, let's go ahead and go to resurrection.
I think that there's certainly some reporting in the book about some of his health problems that won't represent themselves. And so I think he'll be better prepared and in better health. And so, you know, this is probably what rock bottom looks like, you know, what we saw in the 2012 campaign. So from that standpoint, I think you have a little bit of, you have a better opportunity next time. However, I will say this, the oops moment and the gaffe sort of, the gaffe-prone campaign and the gaffe-prone nature in general is so burned in, is so deep, that if there's another one of these, that there, you know, it's going to be there. It could easily be, oh, there he goes again.
Don't expect that highlight reel to disappear. You know,
right.
It's all on tape and on the internet.
Well, he's like the best thing since Dan Quayle in some ways.
I'll just add real quickly. I think that one thing that could make Perry still a viable candidate is that his campaign had a template that worked extremely well in Texas. And they were trying to go by, at times, the same template on this national race. If he were to run again, I don't think that's not a mistake that he'll make, thinking that template is going to work in a bigger campaign.
Satan?
All right, on that note, if you have questions, comments, or would like free copies of Jay's book, I can speak this, please email tribcast@texastribune.org. On behalf of Jay, Ben, Ross, our producer Todd, this is Reeve. Thanks for listening.
This is called breath. Breath. Air. Breathe. Air.
That's it?
So that's pretty much the...
This is the whole poem? Air, breath, breath, air? Breath, air, breath, that's the whole thing? I think I was even longer just saying
it. It is sure.
Is the part where you inhale actually written down on there?
I do have a parentheses with nothing in it.
What? To tell you to breathe? You needed a prompt?